Welcome, everybody. It's 10:15. You are in session number 328, Incorporating Progressive Polygamy into Mormon Cosmology. We have a few announcements. Please silence your cell phones so we can be respectful and attentive. This session is being recorded. Everyone who speaks, please speak into a mic so that others who might want to purchase this recording, which you can do at the registration desk in the main area after it's over, can hear what is said. This session is 60 minutes long. We ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. And the abstract for this session: have you ever considered the connections between the polygamous and polyamorous communities? What kind of connection can be made between the queer and non-monogamous communities? This panel explores these questions and more to discover ways non-monogamy intersects with the queer community through a Mormon lens. And we have three presenters with us today. Right here we have Brady Williams, who is a former Mormon fundamentalist and reality TV star. Brady and his wives are featured on TLC's My Five Wives. And then in the middle we have Blair Osler, is a writer and philosopher with a focus on queer theory. She is a board member and former CEO of the Mormon Transhumanist Association. And then on the end we have Joseph West, is a sociologist and father of two. He lives in Tucson, Arizona, where he is an active participant in the ethical non-monogamy, that's ETM, community. And I'm going to turn the time over to them.
Yeah, go for it.
Hi, y'all. So I guess I get to go first, and I'm going to talk to you about progressive polygamy and our journey. And thankfully, I've got a couple of my wives in the back, and I was saying I should have probably brought my whole family and fill up the room for a crowd. And then everybody would, at least my kids and wives, would laugh at the right times and ask good questions. All right. So I'm going to read a few remarks, and then we'll just get going. I remember sitting in this classroom where the cinder block walls had been painted over one too many times, a pale yellow that looked like rubber. I couldn't have been more than 10 years old. I'm old enough that the Sunday school teacher was still scratching on a green chalkboard the answers to her question. The list was of the world's greatest sins. She had asked the class to call out everything they could think of: murder, adultery, and then polygamy. Weird that a cute little girl with long brown hair would be the first person to introduce a concept that would forever change my life. In the West, meaning Europe and the United States, many share this little girl's belief that polygamy is a sin. But much of the world still holds that polygamy is a virtuous and deific mandate. I was among them. 30 years later, I would find myself a leader of the Mormon fundamentalist polygamous group, the Apostolic United Brethren, or AUB. I drank the Kool-Aid pretty deep. It was blue and it was delicious. I'm talking snarky, but true. I really thought that because I was a member of the AUB and held the priesthood and had received many of the ordinances and had five united wives and worked in their temple and was a 70 apostle and was the bishop and was white and was a man and was heterosexual, that I was somehow better than all those who couldn't say those same things. I believed that God looked down on me as one of his chosen ones. I was in a position of privilege and power over my wives. I was a patriarch. I have since left the AUB, having embraced a progressive worldview in place of the fundamentalist one of my childhood and early adulthood. With this progressiveness came the realization of the hypocrisy of my marriage. I had married five women while a member of the AUB. We, the six of us, all innocently lived by the rules of patriarchy. I was the head of the family and ruled with my wives by my side. I was taught that these five women were to be as jewels in my crown, and that if I proved worthy, would one day be their lord and king. I cringe at how unabashedly I believed this drivel. After years of critical thinking and the reading of many challenging works, my wives and I became convinced the life of a traditional polygamist and the ideal of patriarchy was something we did not want for our family. I believe if traditional fundamentalist polygamists would consider a progressive critique of their worldview, many would embrace an alternative view. Sadly, many shrink from this evolution out of the fear of losing their families. We certainly experienced this fear. It need not be a zero-sum outcome. One can relinquish the idea of male superiority and rule without abandoning one's polygamous marriage. The following is an effort to provide a viable polygamous alternative that abandons traditional patriarchal polygamy while embracing a new progressive ideal. First, polygamy is generally considered a depraved lifestyle, and justifiably so. For thousands of years, women within polygamy have suffered at the hands of men. More than just the subjugation of women, polygamous sects have been guilty of all brands of bigotry, race, gender, and sociopolitical are just a few. There is a dark history of abuse being perpetrated within polygamous sects, and many continue to this day. But, as I will show, it would be a mistake to think that these evils only exist in polygamy. Indeed, they find their advent in monogamy. Perhaps when referring to traditional polygamy, I should instead say traditional patriarchal polygamy. All of the moral problems with polygamy can be blamed on patriarchy and not the multiplicity of one's spouses. I suggest that the issue is not more than one spouse, but the subservience and virtual ownership of one spouse by another. This is not peculiar to polygamy. In fact, it all started with monogamy, as I said. It's called patriarchy. In The Origin of the Family, Private Property in the State, Frederick Engels, through an examination of the teleological history of the family, shows how women went from a position of power to the role of the subjugated sex. Engels gives a broad history of the role of women within the family institution, giving a clear description of the advent of monogamy and with it the evils of patriarchy. This need not be how things remain. The status and condition of women can and must change. Women in all marriage types, whether monogamous or polygamous, are subjected to the problems of patriarchy. Solve patriarchy, take away the ability for a man to dominate a woman, and one solves many of the moral problems in marriage, both monogamous and polygamous. If the moral improprieties were eliminated, it would seem that any consenting, informed adult should have the right to marry. For the interest of time, I'm going to skip over. I tie feminism to progressive polygamy, and I think I'll leave that out. So, progressive polygamy, a polygamous alternative. As I mentioned, after several years of introspection and rigorous study, my wives and I realized the error of our fundamentalist worldview. Progressive polygamy is the brainchild of our desperation to have our cake and eat it too. We were unwilling to sacrifice either our family or our new beliefs. So the six of us set ourselves to the task of creating a marriage unit which could reconcile these seemingly opposing worldviews. By addressing both the moral problems of patriarchy and the structural problems of the poly lifestyle, a new egalitarian marriage system is possible. There are four parts to making progressive polygamy viable. The first is the abandonment of the gender binary. In progressive polygamy, there can be one man with three women, or one woman and three men. Even three husbands or just five wives are okay. Even three husbands and two wives could work. The numbers and gender of the marriage makeup doesn't matter. Second is the empowering of women outside of just the maternal. In progressive polygamy, all spouses share the responsibility of providing for the day-to-day needs of the family equally. Sharing responsibility does not mean all adults must get a job. Rather, that there is an agreement about who is best fit to work and when towards meeting the demands of the family, be it professional or domestic. This would necessarily include female members. A woman within progressive polygamy who once felt it an impossibility to go to university or to pursue a career now finds herself with more adult members in the family who can provide love, devotion, and care for her children. Where once a mother would feel trapped as the only nurturing feminine figure in the home, now there are more mothers and fathers to share in the maternal duties. Now that's a dynamic that should be explored. This is an obvious enabler in the feminist ideal of honoring the maternal as well as inserting oneself into the world outside of the home. Third is the abandonment of patriarchy and the embracing of a progressive worldview. I've written about patriarchy and its penchant for the subjugation of women. It pervades all of society. I'm going to skip down here. Sadly, in the world today, even in so-called advanced first world countries like the U.S., people still believe in sexist, bigoted drivel. It seems that in order for someone to occupy this mental space, they are answering the call to be a bigot. Abandon this immoral mandate of fundamentalism and stifled thought, and the clarity of progress will have room to manifest. I say again, the problem with polygamy is not the number of spouses one has. It is largely how one treats them. The progressive polygamist must not suffer from these delusions. Treat a spouse with moral aplomb, and the progressive polygamist is halfway to a justification of the poly lifestyle. But even after the moral problem of patriarchy is extinguished, a structural one remains. There has always been a central spouse, and with it, inequity of time and commitment. The fourth part to establish progressive polygamy is perhaps the most tedious and certainly the most underanalyzed, the replacing of the hub-and-spoke structure of traditional polygamy with the egalitarian marriage unit model. In place of the hub-and-spoke model of traditional polygamy, the egalitarian marriage unit has just the will. All spouses are married equally to all other spouses, each enjoying the love, devotion, and commitment of all other spouses, be it money, resources, or time. In this marriage, every spouse is married to every other spouse, much like the polyfidelicious model. It is incumbent on every spouse to view the entirety of the marriage as central. That's really important. And in fact, the entirety of the marriage unit becomes the hub, where the man used to occupy the hub. The importance of love and devotion being focused on the marriage as a whole rather than just one central spouse. Also, every spouse has equal in access and voice when determining family policy. Using democratic techniques, each person has an equal say regardless of sex or gender, thus creating a politically egalitarian union. It would be up to all participants to determine the nature of the family government, much like there is a multitude of ways for a monogamous couple to run a family. So to sum up progressive polygamy, first and perhaps foremost, one must not be a patriarchal jerk. We live in a world where there is no excuse to remain bigoted. Women should have equal access to every right and privilege that men have. Obviously, this includes marriage and particularly the more historically bigoted variety of traditional polygamy. Second, the structural deficiencies found in traditional polygamy and the hub-and-spoke model must be replaced by the EMU, or Egalitarian Marriage Unit. This will ensure equal access to family government and the right to sex. If this arrangement is not conducive to any of the participants' current worldviews, and this is really important, they should feel unfettered to break the marriage contract and seek companionship elsewhere. While theorizing about the idea of a progressive polygamy is all well and good, I admit that the implementation in real life is much more messy, as is the case with all theories. And that, I'll turn it over to you guys.
Started because I was on a podcast with Lindsay, her Your Polygamy podcast, and I was talking about an idea called queer polygamy because I'm weird like that. And she said, this is great. Let's get together and do a Sunstone panel. So here I am going to further expand on the theological exploration and explanation of how progressive polygamy can fit into the Mormon, LDS Mormon tradition. According to many accounts of Mormon theology, polygamy, also called celestial marriage, is a necessary mandate for the highest degree of celestial glory. Doctrine and Covenants 131 and 132 tells us that celestial marriage and the continuation of the human family is what enables us to become gods, because we will have endless and everlasting increase. Doctrine and Covenants gives a direct warning that if we do not abide by the law of polygamy, also called plural marriage, we cannot attain this glory. The scriptures and prophets state that theosis and plural marriage are intimately intertwined. Brigham Young, being the most notable advocate of mandated polygamy, stated that the only men who become gods, and even the sons of gods, are those who enter into polygamy. However, he also wrote, if you desire with all your hearts to obtain the blessings which Abraham attained, you will be polygamous, at least in your faith. It's interesting that he uses the words, at least in your faith. Was this to suggest that a man can not practice polygamy on earth, but will in heaven? Or is this to suggest that a man may never enter into a polygamous marriage, but may live the spirit of polygamy in his heart? Later, Wilford Woodruff remarks that President Young said there would be men saved in the celestial kingdom of God with one wife, many wives, and with no wives at all. Wilford Woodruff again stated that President Young spoke and said men may embrace the law of celestial marriage in his heart and not take a second wife and be justified before the Lord. What is to be made of these conflicting statements? How can one embrace the spirit of polygamy and celestial marriage, but remain monogamous with one or even no wives? In this paper, I will refer to the sex-focused, androcentric, patriarchal, heteronormative model of polygamy as the standard model. At a glance, the standard model is a mistake and highly problematic. Though the standard model tends to dominate discourse, a more creative interpretation of what polygamy may include may offer us new insight into what celestial relationships look like. I am suggesting a way to reconcile diverse desires for celestial marriage under a new model I call queer polygamy, which encompasses the spirit of polygamy without mandating specific marital relations. I will begin with an expository of the standard model of polygamy, followed by an expository of the queer model of polygamy, and demonstrate how plural marriage may be redeemed to accommodate diverse relationships and desires, as Wilford Woodruff suggests. I will then point out five common concerns with the standard model of polygamy and how queer polygamy model addresses them. So first, the standard model of polygamy is often reductively described as one man having multiple wives. The man will continue to increase in power and dominion according to the wives and children he accumulates. This means he is eternally sealed to his wives and his children, just like God, Heavenly Father, who must also enter into plural marriage, also called celestial marriage. To attain the highest degree of celestial glory and have eternal increase, a man must enter into polygamy to dwell in his celestial kingdom forever and ever. In this model, the man or patriarch is the focus of the narrative with little regard as to what women or children desire. This aesthetic of God and godhood is problematic for many reasons. This view paints a rather androcentric and domineering perspective of what polygamy might look like. Additionally, this makes God an overly anthropomorphized singleton whose power and glory isn't shared with his family and community, but at the expense of his community. If that is the case, this God's power is, as the lone patriarch, is not a holy power, but a tyrannical power. I believe queer academia and theology is ripe with possibilities to reconcile these diverse aspirations towards Zion in queer polygamy, which accommodates a potentially infinite number of marital, sexual, romantic, platonic, and celestial relationships. The words queer polygamy almost seem redundant. Polygamy is inherently queer according to contemporary monogamous social expectations. Polygamy, by Western practice, is a deviation from the norm. The words queer polygamy might also seem to imply that one must necessarily be a member of the LGBTQ+ community for these ideas to apply. But this is not the case. Rest assured, heterosexual monogamous couples are an important subset under the umbrella of queer polygamy. A person with one, many, or no spouses can be included in this model. The use of the word queer in queer polygamy is also meant to signify a thoughtful and thorough interpretation of polygamy, which would be inclusive of such diversity that many of its manifestations would rightly be considered queer. As you read, you may find this model strangely foreign, but oddly in harmony with Mormon theology from a logical and practical approach. The standard model of polygamy is problematic for essentially five reasons. The five most common concerns are as follows. 1, leaving room for monogamous couples. 2, leaving room for women and other genders who desire plural relationships. 3, leaving room for asexuals, aromantics, and singles. 4, leaving room for homosexual relationships. And 5, leaving room for plural parental ceilings. First, an unnuanced reading of Doctrine and Covenants 132 appeals to a patriarchal and androcentric model of polygyny, However, this exclusive polygynous model demonstrates the concerns of women who do not wish to engage in plural marriage without their consent, such as the case with the Law of Sarah. By extension, the standard model does not leave room for couples who wish to remain romantically or sexually monogamous. However, there is room for monogamy in the queer model. To demonstrate this, I'd like to refer to queer sexual orientations, not as universal orientation or socio-political identity labels, but specific practices within specific relationships. For example, I identify as pansexual by orientation. I engage in specific relationships differently, such as a relationship that's asexual, aromantic, and a platonic relationship with my sister. This is not to intend to mean that my relationship with her is void of intimacy, depth, love, commitment, and loyalty. Quite the opposite. I feel all those things for my sister and more. But we have no desire to engage in a sexual or romantic connection with each other. This does not mean my sister is any less important to me than, say, my husband, who I do desire a sexual and romantic relationship with. It just means the relationship dynamics are different. In the queer polygamy model, I could be sealed to my sister platonically for all eternity, while also being sealed to my husband in a relationship that does include sex. I would be sealed to two people plurally, but I would still be practicing sexual monogamy. Thus, for couples who desire to practice heterosexual monogamy with a partner for all eternity, may be still sealed to other people plurally, but only engage in heterosexual monogamy. Second, the account given in Doctrine and Covenants 32 does not explicitly address women who wish to also engage in plural relationships alongside their husbands. This exclusively polygynous model of polygamy can create a disturbing and problematic power imbalance among the sexes, especially for women in heterosexual relationships. Under the queer polygamy model, plural sealings would be available to all consenting adults, not just men. As stated above, women could be sealed to other women, and just as women are sealed to children and parents. But I'm suggesting a change in policy which would allow multiple sealings to women, to other adults, who they are or are not related to, just as men are afforded that privilege in LDS temples today. Though the scriptures do not state women can have more than one husband, it does not say they can't have more than one husband. In fact, more than one of Joseph Smith's wives was also married to other men. This shows there is room in our religion for women who desire to be married to multiple men, including heteroromantic, sexual, or asexual relationships. It would be up to the participants to decide the relationship dynamics of their sealing or marriage, just as Joseph Smith engaged in sexual relationships with some, but not all his plural wives. There are various reasons for plural marriage and sealings which don't involve sex. Granted, legitimacy of sexual relationships through a sealing or ritual may be important to avoid carelessness or promiscuity among sexual relationships. But above all, honesty and open communication is key to respecting the autonomy and volition of all participants, though I concede past participants of polygamy did not always practice in such a manner, namely Joseph Smith. Third, a candid reading of the doctrine of polygamy, also celestial marriage, does not leave room for persons who do not desire marriage or asexual or aromantic relationships. As stated above, there is room in queer polygamy for asexual and aromantic sealings. Sealings of kinship, friendship, and love may be offered to persons who do not wish to engage in sexual or romantic relationships with each other. Plural marriage for asexual persons could be an asexual woman married to a heterosexual couple, or three asexual persons who wish to be sealed together in plural marriage, which does not include sex. Again, sealing and or marriage is not tantamount to sex. Asexual persons and persons who wish to remain single could be sealed to multiple people through parents, siblings, friends, and partners without committing to sexualized or romanticized notions of marriage and sealings. Fourth, the standard model is aesthetically heteronormative, leaving out the experiences and desires for homosexuals, bisexuals, pansexuals, and other queer persons. This may be one of the more difficult aesthetics to overcome because the common perception of Mormon theology implies there is no such room for homosexual unions in celestial cosmology. I do not see why this necessarily must be the case. I've written several pieces on how we could re-envision reductive views of creation to include homosexual relationships, including creation, procreation, reproduction, and families. In my view, homo-interactive creativity, which also includes homosexuality, is a required aspect of godly creation. If there is anything evolutionary biology has taught us, it's that the creation of life and flourishing of the human species is far greater than heterosexual monogamy. I have no reason to think that God wouldn't use natural means and natural laws of creation to enable life, goodness, relationships, parenting, and flourishing. If this is the case, it is possible for plural homosexual relationships to exist under the queer polygamy model. The queer polygamy model leaves room for same-gendered ceilings and same-sex ceilings, whether they are platonic, like with me and my sister, or homosexual, with me and another woman. It could be the case that plural marriage includes multi-gendered partnerships, such as ceilings among sister wives, that may or may not include acts of lesbianism. If a man is married to two women and the women are bisexual, they may choose to be sealed to each other and have a romantic and sexual relationship with each other as well as with their common husbands. Likewise, a trans person or trans woman might be married to a cisgender man and cisgender woman, but if all identify as pansexual, it could be the case that they are all romantically and sexually involved with one another. The takeaway is the gender is irrelevant to whether or not there's sexual activity in the plural ceiling. That would be up to the person in the ceiling to decide. Fifth, the standard model doesn't leave room for children who have autonomy to be sealed to multiple and diverse parents. In the standard model, children are the property of their fathers with little say of how they may be sealed and unsealed to their parents. For example, a child born in a heterosexual marriage may be sealed to both parents, but if the father is gay, divorces his wife, and both marry other men, the child of the first marriage would have four parents, one biological father, one biological mother, and two stepfathers. Under the queer polygamy model, the children could be granted plural ceilings as well to both the biological father and mother, but also both their stepfathers. The children would be sealed to three fathers and one mother, though the dynamics of the relationship are diverse and fluid among the parents. Essentially, a child could be able to be sealed to all the parents they love. This is not the case under the standard model that focuses on who the child belongs to and in the eternities instead of who the child desires to be sealed to. A child should not be forced to choose between fathers and mandates of heterosexual monogamy or patriarchal polygamy. Children with plural parents should be granted plural ceilings for those that desire them. No child should have to divorce a parent, just as no wife should necessarily have to divorce a husband to take a second. The spirit of polygamy in this model is essentially the love of community. This is the new law that the saints of Zion should embrace in order to become gods. The spirit of polygamy encompasses diverse unions of gods and all the complexity and intricacies. The spirit of polygamy includes and reaches beyond the legitimization of sexual relationships. The spirit of polygamy means that I might be sealed to my best friend, regardless of whether or not we share a sexual relationship. Essentially, queer polygamy means infinite possibilities fulfilled by our infinite love for one another. Thanks.
Bit nervous. This is kind of my first time ever being public as stating my identity as non-monogamous, and surprisingly nervous. I didn't expect to be this nervous, but I live in Tucson, Arizona, with my partner Kate, who is here and is a therapist, and I have this plug. I help her organize this conference. It's a conference on ethical non-monogamy in March, so if you want to check that out, I also have cards. The only conceptual thing that I want to talk about really quickly is this is like an idea of how discourse progresses or how beliefs progress, and the way Hegel stated it was there's a thesis or like a system of belief, and then there's something that comes to oppose that, and then through the conflict, the conflict between those two ideas is transcended to a synthesis. And this was expressed similarly in Nietzsche's idea of these three metamorphoses of the camel who takes the burdens of his community without question and then transforms into a lion. The lion is like the destroyer of values, similar to the antithesis. And then Nietzsche talked about the lion becoming a child, which is like pure creation. So the lion is indiscriminate destruction, and the child is indiscriminate creation. And the reason why I say this is because I fit so presently into the antithesis category, or the lion. And so, like, I was trying to think of, I was actually, when I was first presented with the title of the panel as on progressive polygamy, I kind of was, you know, cringed a little bit, because I don't personally identify as a polygamist, but I also don't really identify as polyamorous necessarily either. I don't think there really is a positive expression for what I personally identify as at the moment. And so I think that I would say that I'm a relationship anarchist. And what I mean very specifically about with that is, so thinking about anarchism or atheism or anything that's like an identity category that's only defining itself in negative terms, meaning it's defining itself against something else. And I think that that is ultimately, it's like an adolescent stage. It's in the lion stage. It's culturally weak. So we should be seeking to find some kind of positive identity, but I'm not really sure what that is, because I'm not really attached to marriage as an institution. I'm not sure, you know, I'm not abandoning it either, but it's kind of an open question. And so when specifically what I mean by relationship anarchy is where anarchism is a rebellion against a particular form or government or way of thinking or structure, okay? So in the way that we think about relationships in our culture and society is very structured by ideas, romantic notions of monogamy specifically, but also like you meet someone and there is a script that's like, this is what happens in a relationship, step one, step two, step three. And so I think that when I say relationship anarchist, what I mean is actively resisting those structures and not trying to be, you know, prioritizing romantic relationships necessarily, although that can be the case. And I think that in terms of incorporating ideas from Mormonism, Michael Quinn's book on same-sex dynamics in 19th century Mormonism, he talks about a term called homosocial cultural orientation, where and he gives, there are several historical examples, but the one that I really appreciate is Joseph Smith talking about soon or a few days before he was arrested, and his like embracing of a male friend, you know, through the night even, but it was like not necessarily erotic or seen as erotic. It was like a different way of thinking about relationships. And so I think that's what I mean also in terms of relationship anarchy, is just trying to think in new ways, but not necessarily knowing what the actual positive statement of that is. So I think that in the spirit of, you know, the lion and of moving forward and incorporating some kind of progressive polygamy or progressive non-monogamous way of thinking into Mormon ideas, I do want to talk about the book by Carolyn Pearson, The Ghosts of Eternal Polygamy. And I kind of want to offer just a reverent and humble critique because of that, because I do, you know, think that her writings are a treasure in Mormon culture and about Heavenly Mother and thinking about the feminine divine. And I think that, okay, the way that I kind of want to say that is that there's a particular brand of feminism, and you could kind of say second wave feminism or like liberal white feminism also, that is basically like non-intersectional feminism, okay? And the problem with this is that it tends towards erasure. So queer erasure, trans erasure, and alternative family erasure, importantly here. And there's a term woke, like we're supposed to be woke. And I kind of don't necessarily like that term. In the sociological literature, they talk about that as cognitive liberation. But, you know, in the parlance of our times, I will talk about being woke. And I think that the problem with this kind of feminism that I'm trying to like vaguely and humbly critique, recognizing the irony as like an advocate of intersectional feminism as a cishet white male critiquing someone, you know, a female, you know, so taking that irony into account, I would say that the thing that I think of is in the Book of Mormon when King Lamoni has been struck dumb by Ammon's words and the servants come in and his body stinketh, they say, you know. And Lamoni's wife can't really smell the stinky smell, but the servants can. And I think that the reason for the smell, you know, the wafting odor, and this is kind of what I'm talking about. I'm trying to appeal to something aesthetic in what bothers me about this particular brand of liberal feminism, that it stinketh. It's like not completely woke because of the erasure that takes place when you advocate for this particular brand of feminism. And I think that the biggest problem with it is that it's like shame-based. So I would say that the Ghost of Eternal Polygamy as a book is basically like a shame manifesto on why we should, you know, be ashamed of the past. And so I think to kind of like to be the lion. So I do think that the point of agreement there is that there is plenty to critique, and I appreciated Brady's words about that. There's plenty to critique about polygamy, but the question is how to go about that. And I would say that a shame-based critique of those kinds of things is basically like a toothless lion, that it has no power. It just is not persuasive, and it doesn't create the kind of change that I am interested in. And so, let's see. This is my great-great-great-grandfather, Israel Barlow. And in 2004 or 5, he had a statue dedicated to him in Nauvoo, Illinois, and I went to the dedication. And is the statue that – this is the place monument, but there's a much larger statue in Nauvoo on the corner across from the temple. And there was an opportunity to pre-order these little miniature versions, and so I was going to get one. But as soon as I saw it, I was like struck with shame that here we have this monument to a husband and a wife, you know, in a monogamous appearance. And even in searching on the internet for images, the only way to find out about his other wives, which there it is printed on the back of this stone, and the children from those wives, is like you can't even find an image of it on the internet. And so that's what I mean. It's like a very specific example of the erasure that takes place. So this is something that I feel shame about, not because my ancestors, you know, did some crazy stuff, tried to live a different way of life, but because we don't honor them. We choose to pretend or present them as something that they weren't. So this is not honoring him and his practice, because this is an incomplete version of the way that he lived. And so, I mean, I think that I don't personally know how to incorporate an idea of progressive polygamy into Mormon cosmology. I just feel like I'm not... I don't know how to do that, but I do know that the way forward is not through being ashamed of our past and trying to erase the practices and things that our ancestors did, but instead to embrace that and honor that. And that doesn't mean not critiquing it. It just means that we choose to venerate those ancestors for the choices that they made. And that's what I got.
We have 23 minutes left for questions and answers. If you'd like to come start a discussion, please speak into this mic. You can address your question specifically to Brady, Blair, or Joseph, and you guys can respond individually, or you can pass the mic around and I'll respond to however you'd like to respond.
So I'm Connor Hilton. And my question's mostly for Blair, but Brady and Joseph can weigh in if they feel the desire to. So if we embrace this model of queer polygamy, mm-hmm. how do we like project that onto our conception of deity? Mm-hmm. So within Mormonism, we typically have right, like this coupled God of a Heavenly Father, Heavenly Mother. So how do you model kind of this broad spectrum without like potentially erasing either men or women?
Right. Okay. So the projection of the aesthetic of a godhood right now is definitely the domineering singular male aesthetic. And then over here we have Heavenly Mother, and some people talk about multiple Heavenly Mothers, but we keep her in the shower in the shadows because it's all controversial, right? That's not necessarily the way I see it. I see it more the way Joseph Smith described it in the King Follett sermon, which is a plurality of gods. God is a community. So just as like there's a million different expressions of what it is to be human, it's the same thing for God. And the Heavenly Mother, Heavenly Father aesthetic, I don't have a serious problem with as far as it's recognized as maybe like potential offices one may hold in their godhood. But godhood inherently is plural in Mormonism when everybody has the potential to become said God. So any God that developed into this anthropomorphized singleton, singularly, that's not the way evolution works. That's not the way we're headed. If it is, like, it's not God anymore. That's Satan, because he built his power upon other people and then left his community behind. And so I don't see that as anything we should really even try to worship towards. If anything, we have the template of Zion and this transcendent community that transcends into godhood together. So I see God just as diverse as every single person on the planet.
I mean, I think that's kind of a question of the gender binary also, like, is God gendered? And so, like, in the Mormon temple ceremony, participants are instructed to think of themselves respectively as Adam or Eve. And I think that there is something incomplete about that. See, like, I don't necessarily want to abolish the gender binary or, like, get rid of gender. I just think that we need to recognize that gender binary exists embodied in all of us, and that even like literally and genetically, we are all come from females as much as males. So the feminine divinity is embodied within me as much as masculine divinity. It's more just like how we choose to conceptualize that. And I think that of a similar thing about God. So that like we may think of God as specifically a specific instantiation as gendered, but God in a more total sense does not need to be, is more like a community that's inclusive of all that, those things.
Hi, Ben.
So in some ways, I see us evolving as a culture. I mean, genetically, we're not evolving as fast as our culture is evolving. And so I kind of see this as a cultural evolution. We've got the civil rights movement that's led into this LGBTQ rights movement, which I think are tied together. And I think we're also starting to see an emerging relational rights movement, if that makes sense, you know, and it's sort of a fluid transition from one thing to another. And assuming that society becomes more healthy because of acceptance of plurality of relationships and queer polygamy, as you stated, society had to change a little bit, like corporations had to change a little bit to accept the LGBT community and gay marriage and things like that. How does society need to evolve, or what are the most important adjustments that society needs to make to integrate queer relationships into our day-to-day and make it normal and healthy for everyone in the types of relationships that they want to have? So that's my question.
Okay. So if I'm understanding your question correctly, you're saying how do we evolve as a culture and a society to be able to accommodate the queer polygamy model? Okay, gotcha.
So we can learn a lot, like exactly what you said, from the civil rights movement and the LGBTQ movement. I think one thing that dramatically needs to change is a lot of it has a lot to do with aesthetics. Like, our music idealizes monogamy. Like, there's this narrative, like what you were talking about, Joseph, that there's this single person, and if you find this single person, they will be able, and in Mormonism, they will be able to fulfill your eternal needs, your emotional needs, your sexual needs, your intellectual needs, not just for this life, but for the whole freaking eternity. And I feel like that's just like, oh, really? Exactly. Like, that's way too much pressure. Like, monogamy is just too much pressure. Like, and so I feel like in some ways, like, and this just isn't just a Mormon problem. This is a cultural problem. This is what we see in the movies. This is what we hear in music and ad nauseum of what the narrative is supposed to look like. So I think one thing we need to do is maybe kind of fix our aesthetics to incorporate other things. Just like with queer people, it's like, well, representation matters, right? We need trans persons playing trans roles. We need homosexual couples in sitcoms and things like that. So one, I would say aesthetics and representation. I think another big thing, I don't know, maybe this is controversial, maybe it's not, but I feel like religions need to change from within, that this needs to be an organic change that happens within religion, because religion influences politics and policy and things like that. You can say there's a separation of church and state. Yeah, that's not true. That's not true at all. So we need to see this change in our cultural value biases, and a lot of that has to do with the way we're engaging with religion, which is one of the things I'm doing now. And the funny thing is, like, it's still so Mormon. Like, I feel like a lot of the things I'm saying, like, it's just too Mormon for the LDS church right now, because, like, it's like telling them their own theology. Like, hey, it's right there. Anyway, I kind of got off track there. But those are a couple ideas. You?
Go ahead.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry.
So, like, written into the Supreme Court decision that legalized gay marriage is an explicit statement that it applies to, that making gay marriage legal does not imply anything about polygamy or plural relationships. And so I think that's just kind of like the fundamental shift that's where there's a prioritization of a dyadic relationship, and that's like the kind of relationships that we choose to support as a society, and that just won't ever work in terms of like incorporating some of these more specifically Mormon ideas about plural families. So.
One thing that's come to mind as well is there's even some academics with LGBTQ plus academics who don't even recognize the validity of a plural lifestyle, and this monogamous mindset is so ingrained, and I think it has a lot to do with the socioeconomics that are involved in the complexity of doing a plural. I mean, you're going to upset more than just religion or day-to-day life. You're talking about money, and money's pretty important to people. So,
the one thing I kept thinking about is this erasure concept that you brought out at the end. And I feel like as a polygamist from a polygamist community, we contribute to that constantly, right? Like you were saying, and by the way, congratulations for coming out of the closet essentially as a non-monogamist, okay? We don't even have those terms. We're borrowing them a little bit from the LGBT community, but what do we do to stop that erasure? I kind of wonder if you have any suggestions about what we can do. Like, for example, here at Sunstone, I've seen quite a few different polygamists that I know. None of them came with more wives than one at a time, so that they could still portray this kind of monogamous view.
I did.
You did. Good job. I've talked to several polygamists, and it's like, you know, one wife at a time in public usually, things like that. What can we do? I think to make people notice, like you said, with the statue. I mean, these other wives are so marginalized that their names aren't even on the front of the monument, and they're not depicted. Like, how can we fix that?
So I'll just start off on answering. Well, yeah, I think it just takes courage, and it takes embracing, being proud of the fact that you are poly, a poly lifestyle, and that's really stigmatized. I mean, it was only when the gay rights became public and people started having courage and would go to a movie, you know, holding hands with their
with their lover, you know, that they've started having to be accepted. And I just think, I think it's going to take courage and forthrightness for that to just happen.
In the queer community, there's the concept of bi erasure, to where bisexuals and pansexuals are going to be identified with the person they're sleeping with at that moment or married to at that moment. So essentially a bi person doesn't exist because they're either, you know, a lesbian if they're with a woman or straight if they're with a guy. And there's been a lot of things done to combat this idea of bi erasure, which I think is applicable in some ways. The thing that kind of stinks about it is exactly what he said. It's being brave enough to go ahead and be open about who you are and what you're doing and the people you love and care about. Specifically for me, it means coming out of the closet all the time whenever someone assumes something about my sexual orientation or my gendered experience. It's constantly coming out of the closet, which can be annoying. But in some ways, I've learned I'm not going to carry other people's baggage. I'm not going to carry their shame, and I'm not going to make their issues my issues. And one thing that makes them uncomfortable is the fact that I won't share their shame with them. I won't share that baggage. I don't feel badly about it, and I don't need to feel badly about it. In fact, I feel freaking good about it. And that in and of itself challenges people to say, oh, well, she's okay with it. I guess I should be okay with it. To where if you carry that kind of confidence, and I'm a little bit, it's okay to fake it till you make it a little bit. Not like deceptively, but just a little bit of like, carry that confidence, say, yes, these are my wives, and I'm damn proud of both of them.
So yeah. I just wanted to follow up on that. I think that, what that does is it normalizes it. Because I can say just anecdotally that, you know, I'll go to every spring scene at the elementary school, and I'll have three or four wives around me because we got all those many kids, and I just embrace it. And in the business world, everywhere, and it is very, very rare that if a person gets to know me and they see that I celebrate my lifestyle, they're happy to celebrate it with me. It's people. I mean, there's a very small portion of the, in my opinion, of the population that will want to hate you for your choices. They may not agree and participate with you, but they'll be okay with you, and they'll love you and want to get to know you. And I just think you just have to normalize it more by being forthright and out there. So
I wrote down my thoughts, so sorry if the presentation's a bit stodgy. First off, absolutely brilliant presentations, and I can't think of a single thing that you guys said that I would disagree with. I just think it was really hopeful and supportive and illuminating, so thank you for that. My question is primarily for Joseph, and I'd like to say briefly that story you told about your ancestor I completely identify with. My great-grandmother was born in the year 1900 in Colonia Juarez, before Pancho Villa and the Revolution kicked the Mormons out of northern Mexico. And I had to learn a lot of these details from a Vice News story. I didn't get it from my own family. And so I really appreciated that. So some context for my question, and the question is about hope. I consider myself something of a word nerd and a bit of a happy nihilist, if you will. I'm also an anarchist. And Joseph, you alluded to the fact that anarchism is a negative stance, right? It's against something like atheism, because in Greek that prefix, the letter alpha, is all about negating it. And so it's, the word means against rule, against first principle, stuff like that. But I also know that the word anarchism can mean building up or towards a new kind of norm or a new kind of rule. And the key difference between those two meanings being the first one, the negative one, has the alpha as the prefix, and then you add the letter N, or new, because the root begins with a vowel. But there's another prefix in Greek, which is ANA, ANA. And it means moving upward and inward, and it appears in some technical theological terms like anabasis or anagogy. And so what I love about this panel is it assumes that radical or anarchic kinship relationships that can remain sustainable over time without assuming a kind of suffocating permanence. And I was just wondering if you see a way of being and remaining anarchist in a hopeful, sustainable, childlike way in Nietzsche's sense. Yeah.
I mean, I think that as far as anarchism as a as like an identity category. I know that like there is a relationship anarchy website. They have like a whole manifesto that I don't necessarily identify with completely. And that like when I say that I see it as an identity that's only defined in negative terms, and therefore I would, for me personally, I would say culturally weak. Okay. Same with atheism. It's just like, meaning that it's not something that's positive in the strong sense that I would like to be. But that's kind of like my personal definition. And I know that, I mean, I've had conversations with anarchists who don't necessarily agree with my idea of anarchy as a, you know, adolescent stage or like in the antithesis stage of the dialectic. And so I'm totally fine with that. And, you know, so that's why I was trying to be so clear about what I mean specifically about it. But yes, thank you. Those are all good points. If you just look up relationship anarchy Google, I can't remember the exact website. But.
Thank you all three. This was great. So I don't, kind of piggybacking on Ben, and was it Ben too? Ben and Ben? Kind of their questions, hopefully a little bit different so it's not repetitive, but you know, people often say with the queer movement, it rapidly was accepted, which it was. But when you really talk about it and you talk with some of the movers and shakers that really started it, they talk about how that isn't really the case. And it was a bunch of these millions of small things that happened on the grassroots level to have it play out, not something necessarily huge. And I think that's going to apply for non-monogamy movement. Both in the church and outside. My question is, you've talked about sort of the three of you in your different ways approaching non-monogamy of how you can help sort of proselyte it to have people accept it. I'm curious what advice you would give to people that maybe want to sort of share these ideas with maybe more conservative people and what they can do on the grassroots level to kind of share the good word, so to speak. The people that maybe aren't going to be practicing non-monogamy, but they want to take home to their family or friends to sort of spread this because it's something we don't really talk about. And how can we, in small ways, get the word out to kind of show it's not this evil thing?
I think the answer to that is the same answer to a lot of the world's woes. You just have to humanize. And yet you have to say, those polygamists really aren't that much different than you. And so that you can embrace. And the only way to do that is to get to know them, you know, and to identify with them. And so I think it takes a lot. One of the problems is fundamentalists within the Mormon universe of poly, well, even the Muslim and the fundamentalists, is they're so closed and they're so hard to access and they're so hard to get to know. You know, and so that's a real problem. And they don't want to be affiliated with the LGBT community, right? So there's a lot of problems trying to bring this out and normalize. But that's what I think. I think is go get to know someone. Go find someone and talk to them and see what they say. That's the best way to get a more conservative person to know you. I mean, just within my own family, it was so hard to get my grandfather, who's, you know, multi-generational Mormon, who his great-grandpa or his grandpa was a polygamist, but he wouldn't accept me as a polygamist, right? So that's what I think. You have to humanize them.
I mean, honestly, this is a disappointing response, but I think that there is, just for me personally, and like the extent of my life that I have spent trying to like coddle people along, I feel like there's some kind of the state that I'm in. It's almost like a political act to sort of refuse to do that. And like, if people are offended, that's fine with me. I'm not trying to be intentionally provocative, but I also just think that I refuse to take, for the time being, I don't want the burden anymore of like, oh, how do we convince these people that are so scared and so afraid to come along? I think it's just like, you know, standing as a witness and, you know, my actions and deeds and the way that I am as a person and as a friend speak for itself. And I think I'm intentionally trying not to strategize about how to, you know, coddle the fearful.
Yeah,
So my question is essentially like, but what about the children? Like, can you talk about adolescent sexuality and these ideas about like erasure are sort of palatable when we're talking about like, oh, we can embrace and honor our polygamous ancestors, but talk about pedophilia and incest and sort of those, the fears of like sexual, progressive sexuality, the fears that people have in reaction to all sorts of progressive sexuality. So like, is it 18 is the age of consent and that's that? Is it half plus seven? You know, what are the rules for protecting children?
I have a lot of children. And I don't see how those rules are conspicuous to plural families at all. Kids don't have sex, you know, young kids. That's wrong. And we have laws in place to protect the innocent. And I think law should be blind to whatever group is abusing a child, period. You know, and you just enforce that. And as far as polygamy and whether or not, I don't know if this was part of the question, but I know like within our family, and I think this should apply everywhere, is no child should be forced to adopt the ideological views of their parents. Like, I doubt any of my children will live polygamy, but as my daughter Hannah said when she was interviewed by the Tribune, but I had the best childhood ever, and I think I have the best moms ever. But would I live it? No, it's pretty hard. So,
first, I'd just like to say that, like, pedophilia, rape, and all sorts of those things, those are wrong no matter what kind of relationship you're in. If you're coming from a monogamous family, still wrong. Coming from a polygamous family, still wrong. Polyamorous family, still wrong. So those are problems that definitely should be and can be addressed, but happen in all types of family dynamics. An interesting thing, like, I don't come from a fundamentalist polygamist background, but my children spend a lot of time in the queer community with me because they have a queer mom. And so we've had a lot of open conversations and discussions about diverse lifestyles and the way people live and things like that. And so for me, it's been an opportunity to educate my children. And in a way, that education has protected them in ways that, like, abstinence necessarily would. And when I say abstinence, I'm talking about abstinence of knowledge, abstinence and ignorance. Like, they're still in the Garden of Eden. Like, that doesn't mean you need to, like, you know, rip your children out of the garden slowly and age appropriate wise. But they're armed with information and vocabularies that children their age are not normally armed with. So, for example, one of my biggest concerns is if something bad were happening to one of my children, like if someone was touching them inappropriately or injuring them, that they would be comfortable coming to talk to me about it. Because no matter how good the relationship is, there's still this culture of like shame that like, oh, someone did something bad to my body, so I'm not going to talk about it. And being so open about different lifestyles, about sex, and about different marital situations, my children have developed the words and vocabulary that like they can have these conversations. So if God forbid something bad is happening, they can actually tell me with their words, like, this is what's happening to my body. My daughter can say, you know, this is my vagina and I'm having a problem, you know, to whereas like most five-year-olds maybe aren't armed with that kind of information. So as far as like protecting the children, we need to educate the children in a non-shameful manner. I mean, it can just be like basic anatomy and biology, teaching them different lifestyles and different ways that people engage in things and how to keep them safe and healthy and happy.
Sure, but we are out of time.
I just wanted to say, when you were talking about how do you share this with other people or make it normal. Mm-hmm. So like 5 years ago, I was the most TBM person there was. And obviously, I'm not anymore. And the way that happened for me was when my brother came out to me as the oldest of 13 kids. I'm first, he's second. He told me, and this was my favorite sibling. And it was just okay. And then I had to go through that faith transition because what I loved about my brother and what I'd been taught didn't work. And so I chose my brother. And that opened up this whole faith transition. And then somehow I ran into Blair on the internet in a bunch of groups.
I apologize.
And it's been awesome and opened up. And I could never imagine myself in a listening in a room like this. But I'm totally, it's wonderful. Polygamy, where I could have shot Joseph a few years ago, you've normalized and made it your wives. And it's just, okay, TBMs can handle it. They've just got to, it's got to be normalized. They've got to know great people like you all and like my brother. That's all I have to say.
Thanks.
All right, let's give him a hand. Thanks.